Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Rose Podcast. Today I got returning guests, and we haven't been doing many guests. We're only special, super brilliant episodes. So Thais Gibson, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here with you.
Well, the last episode we did, people freaking loved, because I think you just do such an incredible job of walking people through attachment and understanding relationships in such a not only palatable, simple way, but an actionable way. So let's jump in.
Yeah, let's do it.
You've been talking about this, and I wanted to bring you on in order to dive deeper into it. And this is this idea of six stages of relationship. So where, I'm guessing we begin in stage one, but how did you come to this? And how do, where do we begin?
Yeah, so great question. So, you know, the six stages of relationship, I would say, are one of the top contenders for what affects us the most in terms of our ability to have successful relationships. And I think first, when we think of what a successful relationship is, we have to sort of define what success is. And when we look at people who report being not just in the longest lasting relationships, but also report the highest degree of personal satisfaction in those relationships, actual fulfillment, to me, that's success. And those people have two things in common. Number one, they are securely attached. And number two, they make it to what I call the everlasting stage of relationship. So we have six stages, and every relationship has a life cycle, just like most things in our lives. And if we get stuck in one part of the life cycle, we'll start to become unfulfilled. We'll have symptoms, in a sense, of frustration, resentment, depending on what stage we're stuck in. And each stage of the six actually has a rite of passage necessary to move on to the next stage.
Ooh,
so
I like this.
In order to progress, we have to see, okay, and the first stage is the dating stage, right? The first stage is all about vetting, and we can go into obviously all the details of each one. But what often happens is people will get stuck, for example, in the power struggle stage, and they'll think, oh, we're fighting more. This isn't working. This is the wrong person, rather than understanding, oh no, I am just at a pivotal crescendo point of the life cycle of this relationship. And if I just know the rites of passage, the exact tools and strategies I need to use to unlock the next stage of the relationship, you would actually move out of the power struggle stage closer than ever and have the ability to progress into future stages to eventually make it to the everlasting stage, which is when people will truly be at a place of longevity, but also at a place of personal satisfaction.
That sounds magical. And I love the simplicity of rite of passage, because of course everyone's like, just tell me how. And I also like the normalization of each stage, because then when you hit it, it's actually a sign of progression rather than a sign of regression.
Exactly. And that's what's so tragic, is so many people, so statistically most people break up in the power struggle stage of relationships, and they think, oh, you know, I just go through this life cycle. Most people spend their entire time in relationships if they're unsuccessful, going from dating stage to honeymoon stage to power struggle stage and then breaking up, and then thinking that relationships are either dating and honeymoon, where we've got the rose colored glasses and everything's great and we're at the infatuation sort of base stages, then into the power struggle stage, then assuming everything is chaos, and their whole experience of relationships is a roller coaster, because they just go from infatuation to power struggle, and then things fall apart and they think, God, relationships are so hard, when in reality, to actually make it to future stages of the relationship, if you're going to be with somebody really long-term and in a long-term commitment, what ends up happening is the dating, honeymoon, and power struggle stage, we're actually a very, very small portion. It usually lasts for the average individual who can do these things right, the first two and a half years of a whole relationship. And then if you're with somebody for decades, that became a very small piece of the entire puzzle. And so after the power struggle stage, we then get into the rhythm stage. Then we get into the devotion stage, and then the everlasting stage. And we'll break down, of course, like each of these stages in a lot of detail, and the pain points and how long they last and the rite of passage for each one. But, you know, what often happens is people also assume that the entire life cycle of the relationship is just the first three stages. And so they go into relationship with new people with a warped perception of thinking, well, I either have these high highs or low lows, and relationships are always so hard. And so as soon as they make it to the power struggle, they think, oh, here, we're on our way out again. This isn't working.
Yeah, here we go again.
Yeah, rather than being able to say, wait, there's actually something I am missing. That's why I keep getting stuck here. let me find out what it is. Let me unlock those natural keys to move into the next stages. And then we have actual relationship progression. And actually what's so beautiful, and we'll get into this, about the power struggle stage is it is our huge opportunity to move from more conditionally based love to more unconditionally based love. Because in the dating and honeymoon stages, we've got the mask on. And so we're acting, we're showing ourselves with conditions. And the power struggle stage, one of the things that brings us into it from a rite of passage perspective is we drop the mask. We let someone in a little more. We get comfortable. We show our fears and flaws. But that also has an ability to increase the potential for conflict because we're seeing more deeply into each other and there's a vulnerability there. And there can be more opportunity for ruptures, right? But if we learn to do those things effectively and in healthy ways, and we learn that the tools needed to move out of the power struggle stage, we actually leave that stage deeply knowing each other more, understanding each other's fears and flaws and wounds, and knowing how to navigate those things with one another. And so we actually leave that stage with deeper roots, more rooted in unconditional love, where we're able to show and know each other without conditions than in those earlier stages. So it's sort of a crisis and an opportunity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And to be able to hold the both end in there, because mostly we just think crisis.
Exactly. You know?
And of course, it's such a different way of even orienting to challenges to think this is an opportunity, the end's the beginning, blah, blah. But we don't usually think that way till we do. So we're like, oh, wait, what's happening in our relationship is a normal symptomatic part of the stages. I'm curious, do the rites of passage so we can get into them, but are the rites of passages, are they requiring moving more deeply into secure attachment? Is that sort of the...
Exactly. So those two things will play into one another. So what you'll see as an example at a very high level, and I think we'll unpack them in a lot more detail because I don't want to not do it justice. But as an example, one of the big rites of passage, there's multiple, but one of the big ones in the power struggle stage to move into the rhythm stage is that we actually have to be able to be vulnerable. And we have to be able to learn to communicate and work through conflict through leading with vulnerability, being able to actually say to somebody, hey, you know, when the situation happens, that actually is hurtful for me sometimes. Or, hey, I feel a little insecure around this situation. Can we talk about it? Can we work it through? Can we bring some clarity to it? And if we don't know how to be vulnerable and talk about our needs, then we're going to have a really difficult time moving beyond that stage at all. And what you'll see, which goes hand in hand, and this is why these two things play off of each other so frequently, is that in order to develop a secure attachment, two of our six major pillars to secure attachment are conflict communication and being able to actually understand and share our needs in a vulnerable way. So these things actually go very much hand in hand. And depending on which way you look at it, if you're using your six pillars to rewire your attachment style and become secure, that will then help you progress through the six stages. But by the same token, if you understand the six stages of relationship and you actually practice the tools and the strategies to move through the rites of passage necessary, you are also significantly more likely to be developing a secure attachment style.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense because you're witnessing yourself in the behaviors that are necessary. Also, the relationship becomes a product of these new or more developed behaviors, which is a natural side effect of being good at repair, is you're going to find yourself beyond, for example, the power struggle stage, because now those ruptures, also it's that beautiful exposing of authentic self. And can this relationship hold authenticity? Yes. For a lot of the relationships that can't, or we continue to hide our truly authentic self, which would be expressing needs, wants, etc. And then the relationship isn't even challenged to become what we want it to be. Yes. Then we get to blame the other person, which is brilliant. That's such a good strategy.
Which then keeps us trapped in all of our themes and patterns. And you know, it's interesting what you said earlier, like the crisis and the opportunity. I think every crisis is also an opportunity. I think at any point in our lives to deepen the relationship to ourselves or have new insight or new awareness. So yeah. So should we get into the roadmap of
each
of the stages? Yeah. Okay, cool. So first stage is the dating stage. And so many people actually just get stuck here where they don't know how to date. The amount of people we even see like in our membership platform where people will come in and they'll say, I am in a position where I've never had a serious relationship. I'm in my 40s and I've never really had a relationship that lasts more than 4 or 5 months before, you know, things end. So people can truly get stuck just here. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of major reasons. So the dating stage generally lasts about 0 to 6 months. Obviously, you'll see that people, depending on their attachment orientation, will lean in a specific direction. So if somebody's more anxiously attached, they are more likely to want to dive into commitment right away. And, you know, okay, we've been on 3 dates and now we're going to, you know, be in a monogamous committed relationship. And you know, that's obviously a very different pacing from somebody else. Somebody who's more dismissive avoidant, for example, is generally going to be closer to that 6 month mark, really delaying commitment. But really at its core, the roots of being able to show up in the dating stage healthily, securely, and effectively are all about, number one, do we actually vet somebody else? So do we go into dating knowing consciously and with intention our own standards, our own needs, our own non-negotiables in relationships? Because the amount of people truly, and I'm sure you see this with working with clients, you know, the amount of people that come into dating and they base their commitments off of, do I find this person attractive and do I have fun with them? You know, a lot of people are literally making dating decisions to move into a commitment from that particular perspective. And so you go in, it's almost like you go on to apply for a job on Indeed and you're like, I'm just going to apply to the first 30 jobs and see what happens. And it's like, well, one's a welder, one's an accountant, what, you know, we have to actually know what we're looking for in order to date successfully at all. And so in the dating stage of relationship, a couple of things we want to go in primed with and prepared with is, number one, your standards, your needs, your non-negotiables. What am I actually looking for? Number two, where am I likely to find these types of people? Because another place people often get stuck in this stage is they go in, they say they want, you know, somebody who's maybe emotionally available and working on themselves and can work through conflict. And then they're going to the bar every Friday, Saturday night to find somebody to date. And of course, you know, it doesn't mean there won't be people like that at a bar, but you're just significantly less likely to find them there than if you go to a personal growth meetup or a conference or some sort of event. And so we want to be intentional about where we're looking. And then we also want to make sure in the dating stage that we are allowing ourselves to be vetted. So it's not just, am I vetting somebody else and seeing how they show up for me, but am I actually showing openly who I am in the dating stage, telling somebody about myself, letting them get to know me to make sure that there's a reciprocal connection? Because a lot of times people will be so scared in the dating stage to show themselves. They want to people please. They want to win somebody over, that they forget that, no. If you want to date properly, it has to be rooted in authenticity. It has to be a sharing and showing of your true nature and yourself. And if that's not there, then you're actually setting yourself up for failure in the future stages, because eventually we will get more comfortable if we pretend we're somebody we're not in the dating stage and we're people-pleasing and we're self-silencing and we're boundaryless all the time. Then by the time you get to the power struggle stage and we naturally drop the mask in that stage, somebody's going to have a much harder time getting to know you at that point. And oftentimes will actually feel betrayed by their partner going, wait, who are you? Like, you didn't tell me these things when we were dating. And so, you know, those are some of the key ingredients that will set us up for success.
That's really interesting. I think the willingness to be vetted, I've never thought of that, like where we're the responsibility that we have to being truthful.
Yes.
That actually comes with not just presenting your best self. I think it's Dan Savage who would say, like, if you want to keep your relationship together, like, just be your best lie self. Like, because you lie so much at the beginning, just be that person because it's the optimized version of you anyways. And I'm like, that's actually pretty funny.
Yeah.
But to think of the responsibility of being truthful because the other person has to be discerning as well. It's so fascinating, though, because so many people are so busy trying to be chosen that they're not actually even where I see most people get stuck, I think, from that more anxious lens, is that they're not even in their own bodies discerning relational alignment. They're just like, do I have chemistry? Must be a match. And I always think, like, where people get so stuck is the other person's not even sure about them. And yet they're sure about the other person. And I'm always like, well, what happened to you that you're certain about people who are uncertain about you?
Exactly. You know what I mean? Yes, I love that point. And you're hitting the nail on the head, because literally people who are anxiously attached, they notoriously underbet. And so you get these polarities where the anxiously attached person, they have a subconscious comfort zone, just like you're talking about, around chasing, because from their childhood, they had to chase attention and affection. And so that's what's comfortable and familiar. And of course, our subconscious mind is dictating 95 to 97% of our decisions. And so they move from a place of, oh, this feels familiar and thus safe. And so that's often where we get the butterflies and the attraction. One of the three major things that actually drives attraction is somebody who represents our subconscious comfort zone for how we treat ourselves. And so, okay, what does the anxiously attached person do in dating? They put themselves last, they self-silence, they don't pay attention to their own feelings and needs. So they're attracted to people who will mirror that back to them. And then they undervet in relationships. And they think, because of their preoccupation of being chosen, that if I win them over, if I'm just people pleasing enough, then I'll be chosen and then they'll fall in love with me. But actually, they set themselves up for disaster in the power struggle stage, because they literally go into dating and this dating stage, and they pretend to be somebody who they're not, or they're too far on their best behavior and people pleasing. And then when they do start to get comfortable eventually, and they do lower the mask, they will have a marked difference of substantially more conflict, substantially more chaos in the power struggle stage. And that is where statistically people break up the most. So even if they think in the short term, oh, by vetting less, by prioritizing being chosen, by people pleasing, I'm more likely to have a long-term commitment, it's actually the exact opposite, because by implementing those behaviors early on, what they're doing is they're setting themselves up for a much more difficult power struggle stage, where things are much more likely to fall apart. And this is partially why you see anxiously attached individuals so frequently go dating, honeymoon, power struggle, breakup, and they go through this life cycle of relationships so consistently. And as people who so deeply want commitment, instead, they're sabotaging themselves from day one by not allowing their authentic truth to be shown in the early dating stage, and not allowing themselves to be vetted.
Yeah, the fear that keeps them in the same behavior recreates the same experience they fear and keeps them in the same behavior. God, that sucks. I've been there.
Yeah.
And it's the worst, because you don't, till you can say, I'm the reason this is happening. Because I think so much of it is like, I'm a victim to their inability to see that I'm not too much or too emotional. But of course, if you restrain all of that self-expression, it makes logical sense that when it comes out, it will be spilly, you know, it will be overwhelming. And the other person's going like, well, you didn't tell me you were like this. Like, you're a lot different. Your representative was much better.
Yeah. the amount of people that I would speak to when I was back in the day, when I was running my practice, I would have all these people come in, and they would say, and I would hear this all the time in different forms, they would say, Thais, I married my wife and then she turned into a monster, or I married my husband and then he completely changed. And it was, they would speak that way under the pretenses or assumption that they got tricked. And I would hear this quite frequently, like maybe around 10% of people, as if they got tricked. And what they weren't consciously understanding of is that we often marry in the stage that we should still be moving through learning. And so we often, you know, people, if you look at the life cycle, dating lasts 0 to 6 months, honeymoon lasts another year to year and a half after that, power struggle then hits around the 2-year mark, give or take. And you can stay in the power struggle forever. If you don't have the rite of passage, people can stay married forever.
Seems like a lot of people.
A lot of people, absolutely. And so people would get married, let's say they meet somebody, they get engaged in the first year, they have a wedding 6 months later, they get married, and all of a sudden they're in the power struggle, and now they're thinking, oh, this person betrayed me, they tricked me, they're not who they said they were. In reality, they just are now in the power struggle stage, and then there's just more to that story and narrative, and there's things that need to be learned. But to exactly your point, like, we set ourselves up to have the same problems that we're so deeply trying to avoid to begin with, by using the behaviors that we're using, such as people pleasing, to try to avoid, you know, losing somebody, but it's actually doing the exact thing that people are instead most afraid of.
Yeah, it feels like the power struggle, then what they do is have a kid. And you should, of course, be having a kid from the rhythm, because the only way, because you're going to get thrust back into the power struggle.
Exactly.
You're gonna be like, wait, this kid just revealed so much more of our stuff. Okay. So what is the rite of passage out of dating?
Yeah. So the rite of passage is when you make a commitment. So what you'll see is that, you know, some people who are more anxious will people please. And so they will, sure, move into the honeymoon stage but not under the right pretenses per se. And by the same token, you know, dismissive avoidance or more avoidant leaning individuals can also sabotage in the dating stage because they overvet. So they flaw find, right? So they will try to find flaws to create distance as a protective mechanism. So we'll see those polarities that way on the extremes. And so somebody may be dismissive avoidant and also set themselves up for sabotage because they never even get to the honeymoon stage because generally they may start really flaw finding, looking for all
like
the reasons
no one's
that
ever
they could
good
be
enough. Yeah. Even though really what they're doing is I'm terrified being hurt by you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And been also there. Yeah. And also they can flaw find because they're looking for all the ways, you know, I really believe that a big reason dismissive avoidance flaw find is because they didn't get healthy modeling for how to move through conflict and navigate conflict and how to hash things out with somebody. And so they tend to lean on this idealized concept of the perfect partner, quote unquote, because they think if I just find the perfect partner, then we'll never have conflict. And that's what I should be looking for because I don't know how to move through conflict. And the reality is it's not about finding somebody you never have conflict with. It's about learning how to navigate conflict in healthy ways, right? And so the flaw finding is let me look for all the ways that there could be a conflict. Let me find my out in advance so we don't have to deal with those things later because they actually just have tremendous learned helplessness around how to navigate those types of situations unless they actually start to work on themselves. To go back to your original question. So the rite of passage is if we do commit and we do make a commitment, that becomes now we've entered into the honeymoon stage. So now maybe you're exclusive or you're in a committed relationship or these types of things. There's an actual conversation had. And that then brings us into, okay, now we're only focusing on each other and now we're in the honeymoon stage and the rose-colored glasses come on. So in this particular stage, some of the big differences or sort of themes that you'll see. Number one, there's actually elevated oxytocin, the bonding neurochemical, elevated dopamine, the motivation neurochemical, hence why you'll often see people in the honeymoon stage motivated to get up and go out every evening with their partner, motivated to go out on the weekends and make plans and go on vacations, whereas in later stages, you may see more of a trend towards comfort and staying in and things of this nature. So you've got your oxytocin, the bonding neurochemical, you've got your dopamine, and we also have elevated phenylethylamine, which is the attraction neurochemical. And so all of these things together create this sort of neurochemical cocktail that then allows somebody to have their rose-colored glasses on. And this stage usually lasts for about a year to a year and a half post-dating stage, and people will feel very happy. They will see things through that fulfilled lens. They will minimize their partner's flaws and they will maximize their partner's good traits and they'll tend to really appreciate those things. But what is very interesting about this stage is that it also mirrors our childhood. So if you look at our classical conditioning experience, you know how we have like the terrible twos? Usually in the first 2 years, you know, children are actually shown much more unconditionally based love because they're more helpless. They haven't started to develop and individuate into their own small sense of self and personality, and they're not saying no. And so the first 2 years of each of our lives, give or take, again, right, similar to the stages here, at a, you know, children are given a lot more unconditional love and they're not told no, and they're not, you know, getting boundaries set with them. And then when children start to be more active around 2 years old, again, give or take, parents have to start the system of classical conditioning, right? You're good for doing this. You're bad for doing that. You're right for doing this. You're wrong for doing this. And interestingly enough, this very much mirrors how we tend to love and treat our partners in adult relationships. And it's interesting as well because our primary attachment figure as adults replaces our parent-child relationships in our childhood. And so you'll see almost the first year and a half, 2 years, give or take, we almost follow the same track, which is there's no really conditioning yet. And right around the year and a half, 2 year mark, we start going, well, my partner does this and my partner frustrates me in this way. And yeah. I don't like this flaw and there's this fear.
You're terrible too. Yeah.
And most interestingly to me, oftentimes the things we infatuate with the most in the dating and honeymoon stage, unless we actually learn to integrate some of those traits that we have put on a pedestal in somebody else, those very things we infatuate with the most follow an infatuation resentment cycle where we then resent them later. So for example, Maybe you date somebody and you're like, oh my gosh, I just love that they're so easygoing. And maybe it's because you're attracted to that, because you maybe you're more uptight or rigid, or you like to follow rules, and you're attracted to this easygoing nature because we're often attracted to our opposite. It's another one of the three fundamental things that drives attraction. But then when the power struggle stage hits, we're then like, they never make plans. They're lazy. They sit around the house too much. They, you know, so the very things that we're so attracted to in the early stages, we will then resent unless we actually integrate them.
You know, one of the things I've realized is that our house, our home, is so much more than just walls and furniture. They're a reflection of how safe, comfortable, and connected we feel. And for me, the rituals I create at home, the moments where I'm winding down at the end of the day, are what make me feel grounded. And that's why I love Cozy Earth. Their bamboo sheets actually regulate temperature, so you sleep cooler and wake up more refreshed. And their bubble cuddle blanket, it's like wrapping yourself in a hug. It's soft, it's luxurious, and it's instantly calming. These aren't just products, they're experiences that make your space feel like a sanctuary. And you know, whenever I go away and don't get to stay in Cozy Earth sheets, I am excited to crawl into my bed. That's how amazing they are. I cannot emphasize that enough. And here's the best part. Cozy Earth backs it all with a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. So it's risk-free. You could truly see how it transforms your nights. So if you're ready to elevate your home life, head to CozyEarth.com and use my code MARK to get up to 20% off. Because home isn't just where you live, it's how you feel. Let's go home with Cozy Earth.
So then that brings us into the power struggle stage right around the 2-year mark. And there's a multitude of rites of passage here, but one of the first ones is we have to look at all the things that we were so attracted to in a person, and we actually have to be able to take on some of those traits to create balance and harmony across the relationship. And where a lot of people, I think, get it very wrong is people get so fixated on this idea of staying in polarity. Polarity of things like masculine and feminine energy is very attractive in the dating and honeymoon stage. But then we actually have to integrate and find a middle ground with somebody and both become whole within ourselves as much as possible in order to properly navigate our way through and out of the power struggle stage. And if we stay in too much polarity from a trait perspective, if we stay, you know, and you can think of all sorts of examples, maybe we can pause here for a second to illustrate it. But can you think of times for you personally where you were really attracted to something in somebody and later on you resented that thing?
Yeah, like I love my wife's organization, but I don't like when it's trying to organize me.
Yeah, that's like a perfect example.
Yeah,
that's perfect. And I
like when it's organizing our house, but not Mark.
There you go. Perfect. And so early on, there will be this sort of attraction point. And I remember for myself, right? And I'm a really good example of this too. When I first met my husband, and this is like 10 years ago now, but when I first met my husband, he was so assertive and just so like, I remember he would just say boundaries to people so quickly, so early on. And I remember being like, wow, that's amazing. Like, how does he, I remember we were sitting in a restaurant and his old boss happened to be there and he said, oh, I want you to come back and work for me. And I remember he's sitting at the restaurant and he said, I would only consider it if you paid me X amount of money, and just said it like off the cuff, just so like nonchalant, just so in real time.
Fire eating being like, steak, just like.
I remember being like, wow, like, he just has no problem like taking up space. And I remember just finding that so attractive. But at that time in my life, I still had boundary issues. And so here I am so attracted to that and kind of mesmerized by that. And then that quickly became in our power struggle stage. Well, geez, he sets all these boundaries with me. And I'm the one always being flexible. And I'm the one always, you know. And so these very things that we start off being so attracted to in the early stages, we then actually have to integrate. So my way of healing that and allowing us to move through this trait piece, which is one of the top four rites of passage out of the power struggle stage, was I had to learn to be healthily assertive, including with him. And he had to learn to integrate a greater sense of flexibility. And when we were able to navigate those things together, we both became more whole and healed as individuals because we now had access to both sides of you know, the whole sense of self. And it then allowed us to have a much greater sense of connection and depth and harmony in the relationship, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you resolve the things that normally keep you in that stage. Is that the rite of passage through there?
One of them. There's a few in the power struggle. So the first one is really to see like, what are our pain points and what are our major differences? Where, because every relationship tends to have these sort of sticking points. I call them trigger cycles, where we get triggered by the same types of things. And if you ask yourself, well, what are each of us being as traits? You know, how are we each behaving in this particular instance? By decoding what that trait is, and then actually coming to center, you know, interdependence there on those things, it's one of the things that will fast track your way out of the power struggle stage first. So for example, sort of going back to that, it was like, okay, I'm getting frustrated because, you know, for me at that period of time, I was like, well, I feel like I'm always the one making the compromises. And I felt very frustrated. And one of the signs that you're in the power struggle stage is you'll start to experience resentment. And I felt resentment. And I knew I was not going to make space for resentment in my relationship. I didn't want any relationship filled with resentment. That was a non-negotiable for me. So I was like, okay, well, what is the resentment about? Well, it's about that I'm being the flexible one and he's the assertive one. And while I respect that, I need a little bit of harmony around that. I need a little bit more give. And so then I was able to come to him, have that conversation, request those things. I also had to develop my own healthy sense of saying no and boundaries, because at the time I was very much stuck in a cycle of doing things out of kindness and love and people pleasing, and then feeling like, wait, like, what about me? And feeling kind of left out in the consideration process. And so as I learned to be, you know, and it, remember, relationships, you know this, but for listeners, relationships show us to ourselves always. One of my favorite quotes is from Rumi. And he says, if I am irritated by every rub, how will I ever be polished? And so every single thing that's irritating us is showing us something. It's polishing us if we look at it through that lens. And so in that particular case, it was like, well, what are our traits here? What are these polarities where we're at two extremes, and how can we come to center? And by us defining that and then having that conversation and both working on that, what I actually saw with him, which was beautiful, is his relationship strengthened really dramatically, where he had more flexibility and room and compromise. And you could see him almost like open up a lot more as a person and enrich a lot of his relationships as a whole. And for me, I had to learn healthy assertiveness still at that point in my life. And by doing that, I suddenly was in a position where that strengthened a lot of relationships for me. I had hard conversations I had to have. I opened up deeper relationships where I felt more seen because I was sharing my truth and my boundaries. And so, you know, the power struggle stage, one of those first major pillars of getting out of that is to find where you're too far in polarity, and that's creating pain points to address the needs necessary in that conversation and to be able to come to center to create wholeness in each of yourselves individually.
That's awesome. That's so great. That to know that the, what is it? If I get irritated by every rub, how do I become polished?
Yeah. How will I ever be polished?
So good.
Yeah.
Because it really contextualizes then again, okay, this thing is coming forth for me so that I can resolve it. So we can build the integration individually so we can actually move into a space of rhythm.
Yeah.
So that's, and you said there's more than one rite of passage?
Yes. Yes. So
that's a big one.
That's a big one. So that's a, and that's one of the major ones. And, you know, the other one, the next big one is vulnerability. And that's inherent with what we just spoke of, you know, because there has to be an ability to recognize your patterns and to talk about them. But vulnerability and communication are the next two, and the second and third. And we have to get really good at it. You know, I think it's funny because you and I were kind of discussing this topic earlier, but I think that sometimes we get so scared that because we have differences, it means we are just different. And thus it creates a separation or a distancing. But I think truly when we learn to vulnerably share our differences and communicate about them, it's actually a really profound joining. And, you know, what I would see over and over again is people go through these stages of dating, honeymoon, power struggle. And so their entire snapshot of relationships is, you know, this infatuation and then fighting and then it ends. And so people fall sort of prey to this concept that, you know, as soon as we're in the power struggle, everything's going to end. You know, as soon as we're fighting more, oh my gosh, things are on the way out. We're going through a rocky stage. That's an inherently negative thing. But truly, the power struggle stage gives you an opportunity to be seen without conditions and thus loved more unconditionally. And so within this stage, you have to actively take off your mask. And if you're doing it, you know, from unhealthy communication, if you're saying you never spend enough time with me, you don't care, instead of, hey, I'm feeling disconnected, I'd love to spend more quality time together, let's plan a fun date on the weekend. You know, if we're speaking in you know, almost behind every criticism, there's a need, right? So if we're speaking in criticism and we miss actually stating the need through vulnerability, through openness, through authentic communication, then we end up in a situation where we can't make it out of the power struggle stage. And you'll see, you know, the power struggle stage will then look like for people in the long haul. And truly, people can stay in the power struggle stage for decades. They can stay married and stay in the power struggle stage the entire time.
Just
and
resentment.
Yeah, poison. Yeah. Poison. And you know, the actual rite of passage is to be able to, you know, in order to unlock anything, you have to learn to be vulnerable. And so, you know, a lot of, if people are looking to start this, one of the first exercises I often give to people is to sit down and to actually write out all of your frustrations in the relationship on your own, not in front of your partner, on your own. What are all of my grievances here with this person? And then draw a column down your page, and in the column next to it, be like, what is my actual fear here? And what is my actual unmet need that I'd like to request? And then when you can package that together, so if you say, if somebody says, oh, my partner's not texting me enough, they're not communicating consistently enough. So maybe your criticism to that person is, they don't talk to me enough, or they don't care, or whatever it might be. Okay, so what is the actual fear? Well, my fear is that maybe they're not in it the same way I am. Maybe I'm unloved or abandoned. What is my actual need? Okay, well, my need in this particular case is to have more consistency in communication. Good. Now you've actually packaged something that's productive for a relationship. Now you can go bring this to your partner and actually have a conversation about it and see progress. And what that allows us to do is move out of thinking about our partner and the relationship in terms of grievances and frustrations, and move into thinking about vulnerability. This is what I need to lead with here. Here's my fear. Here's what I'm afraid. I'm afraid we're growing apart. I'm afraid that you know, we're not on the same page here. Here's what I'm needing and looking for. And when we start to open up those types of dialogues through vulnerability, through speaking about our needs, and through open communication, which are those next three pillars kind of coming together, all of a sudden, we're integrating traits, like we talked about earlier. We're starting to move out of these extremes and into wholeness, both as individuals and within the relationship. And then we're able to communicate and hash out conflict in really healthy, productive ways. And in doing that, all of a sudden, we actually start to see the needle move. And in doing that as well, I think people think sometimes that, oh, when we're in the power struggle stage, we have to talk about everything. There's all this effort. Well, yeah, there is, because you're merging two different invisible worlds, right? Mm-hmm. Like, part of a relationship is one person has an invisible world and all of their conditioning and all of their ideas about what a relationship should look like and their needs and their fears. And so does somebody else. And there's work. You have to break down those invisible walls between the two of you, merge those invisible worlds together. And through doing that over time, all of a sudden you stop having to talk about things so much. So let's say you have a partner who's sensitive to criticism, and a partner who really needs more presence in their relationships, more attunement. Well, the person who knows that their partner is sensitive to criticism, they'll actually start practicing through hashing this out, through having these conversations. They'll actually start practicing being more mindful in their delivery, right? They'll start speaking about things with a little more kindness and thoughtfulness. And if they then share with their partner, hey, I'm also needing you to be a little bit more present and attuned sometimes, then that partner, if they show up and do the work with them, they become more present and more attuned. Well, those were early conversations in the power struggle stage. Those don't have to continue to be conversations over time. If we practice them, we integrate them into the relationship, then they become a part of the actual foundation of the relationship itself. I'm a big believer that we are always conditioning people all the time. We're always being conditioned and conditioning, and everybody's conditioning their partner and vice versa, whether we're consciously aware of it or not. So it's either happening on autopilot, or we actually actively share our needs. We speak vulnerably about what our requests are, and we practice those things, and eventually they get conditioned into the fabric of the relationship. And now all of a sudden, you just have a natural rhythm. Now all of a sudden, things are flowing effortlessly. You don't have to talk about these things. And that's when you know, okay, I've made it out of the power struggle stage.
Oh, it's like the nice phase where you're like, where your wounds aren't driving you anymore. Your adaptive strategies are no longer blocking unconditional love. to be able to, I love those rites of passage, because to be able to set the mass down, the collection of one of the four or many of the four horsemen that we use as a way to protect ourselves, that now we've actually, through repetition and conditioning, learned that we can go past those and actually swim in the space that's beyond, which, as you were saying, like a couple could spend their whole lives in the power struggle because they're so terrified of what lives in the rhythm, like what lives alongside the rhythm, which is the pain that creates all the behaviors. So the rhythm sounds great, but we got to move out of it. So I'm actually really interested in, like, well, why do I want to leave it?
Exactly. It's so funny. That's one of the biggest things people will say is they'll be like, I never want to leave the honeymoon stage. And it's like, well,
yeah, the honeymoon phase is great.
It's great. It's great. But it's still conditional, right? There's so much like, oh, I'm on my best behavior.
You're not in reality anyways. Exactly. Like, you can't even poop around them. So, you know.
There you go.
Not that, so you'll that's, see. You probably don't want to do that in the romanticized everlasting, but you know what I mean? Safety.
Yeah. The comfort level for sure. So what you'll see is sometimes we'll think, okay, that's the stage we want to, like, you stay here and stay stuck in, but again, it'll keep us stuck instead. So once you get out of the power struggle stage, some symptoms of leaving it are that less conflict happens, less having to talk things through. You'll start seeing that you naturally take each other into consideration, not in the way that you would have considered the person, but as you've learned to consider them. So I think this is really important to highlight, and it's very nuanced, but we all, before handling the power struggle stage correctly, if we don't know how, we all project from our perception. So we all try to give to people what we would need. I remember having this client at one point, and she said she was anxiously attached and she had a dismissive avoidant partner, and they've been dating for a few years, and they were just locked in the power struggle stage. And I remember it was like her second session with me. And she said, oh, we got into an argument over the weekend. And he said he needed space for the rest of Sunday. It was on a Sunday and he needed space. And so I cooked him a nice meal and I wrote him a nice note and I surprised him. And, you know, it's such a great example of her giving love as she would need it. And she was so sweet and just so lovely, and she was trying her absolute best. But part of what we have to get right, and that comes through mutual vulnerability in the power struggle, is we have to learn to see people as they are, not as we are. And in doing that, we can actually honor each other's needs more. And so we'll see that by moving out of the power struggle stage, one of the things we've had to have learned to do through that vulnerability, through that communication about our needs, is that we'll have had to learn the person as they are. And then we can properly consider them. So maybe, you know, and I'll use myself as an example. I know I'm an INFJ and I like my space and time. But I know my husband does more, maybe even like 5% more than I do. And so, you know, I know to check in with him and say, like, hey, you know, I'm ready to hang out. The workday's over, but do you just need a little bit of time to yourself? Cause I could use some too, but how much do you want? And we kind of check in about things like that. And he knows, for example, that, you know, I am a little more physically affectionate. And he'll be like, have I hugged you enough today? Like, have I, you know, and he'll check in with things like that. Cause we've learned those things and ingrained that learning over time. And so it's natural and normal. It's not things we have to consciously think about. They exist in the fabric of our subconscious mind. Those are just natural things we'll ask or talk about throughout the course of the day. And that's happening to everybody in one way or another, right? It's either happening through you naturally judge somebody or get frustrated at them or tell an old story, look, they're doing this again, or we naturally have broken through those things through practice. And then those are a part of our new set point, our new foundation of how we see each other. So, you know, what you'll start to see is that it's almost like a parabola. If you could graph it, it's like you see like dating honeymoon and oh, it's on the up and up. And then you get this like peak of the power struggle and peak conflict. But then you'll actually see, like, almost on the other side of the parabola, it starts to go back down. So conflict lessens, you naturally know each other, you naturally consider each other, you're in a rhythm, and you'll feel the sense of, again, more unconditionally based love in the rhythm stage. And you can almost think of the rhythm stage as being the catch your breath stage. Like, you've just been on this. Exactly. Yeah. You've just been on this. Like, oh my gosh, we were so infatuated, and then we were fighting, and then we had to hash everything out and talk everything through. And it's this merging of your inner worlds. And now it's like, oh, okay, we're here. Like it got way easier. And now we can like breathe a little bit. And so you fall into this natural rhythm. But the rhythm stage is actually usually very short lived. So it'll usually be about, about 3 to 6 months. And from the rhythm stage, we then move into the devotion stage. So the devotion stage is, and for people who have lived this, I know you've had this experience, is when you've lived this, what's really cool about it is that when you're in the rhythm stage, it's very, you take a breather, but you also settle in a little bit and you feel comfortable. And there's this sense of, you know, I don't want to say complacency because it's slightly too strong of a word, but there's this sense of settledness, like, oh, everything's easy now. We can just take it easy. But the sneaky part of the rhythm stage is that we can sometimes confuse ease with an unnecessary degree of effort. And that's really where we move into the devotion stage, is that there's still, as with anything, whether it's a job or a career or a relationship, to keep things ticking along, everything's either growing or it's dying, right? And it's extremes. Everything, we're always either growing together or growing apart. And so the rite of passage is, now that you've learned each other, to then start stabilizing in these devoted habits and structures. And I like to think of the devotion stage as, you know, how do we start devoting to longer term commitments? That's when we start thinking about longer term commitments, if we move through the stages appropriately, right? The devotion stage sort of 2.5-3 years in by this time, if you move through the power struggle stage pretty effortlessly. And now it's like, we're making long-term commitments. We're talking about marriage, kids, a future. We're having those types of conversations. Maybe we're actually behaviorally enacting them at this point. Maybe you just got married, or you just had your first child, or, you know, these types of things. But at this stage, it's also the stage of habituation. So we've started to know the things that naturally work for us. And maybe for somebody who's an anxious attachment style and a dismissive avoidant, maybe they've learned that, like, we have habits where we give space to each other for a few nights of the week, and then we do active things twice a week. We go on a date night once a week, and we watch an interesting documentary or show the other one night of the week. And the more we habituate things in this stage, it's honestly one of the biggest tricks to moving into the everlasting stage, because when we have these habits that are naturally there, it also is preventative when we have these new stressors that come into our lives, a job change, your first child, you know, starting a business, whatever it might be. You've just learned each other. You've developed the rhythm, but then you've actually created supportive, habituated habits for the long run that then allow your relationship to weather the storms of change. And that's all going to be what takes shape in the devotion stage. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. That devotion stage, that feels like where you really start to experience the level of grace that can happen in love, that this deeper level of devotion, because I think marriage as a sacrament or practice really lost its sort of sacramental or sacred aspect, and it became a legal function, which I understand the reasons for that, but that there's, we would get married in the honeymoon phase or in the power struggle as a way to avoid dealing with the power struggle, or maybe in that rhythm stage, which would be probably ideal, you know, as you get in there. So it's like, I really think there's a shift energetically that becomes like, we're just going to continue to lay everything at the altar of relationship. And that's such a different way of being. When two people are doing that, that is
a beautiful thing.
Yeah, like they should teach these in schools, you know, these stages.
And you actually spoke of something so important. It's funny, I was just thinking about this as you were saying it too, which is that we will know we're in the devotion stage because it's mutual and reciprocal. And so I love the way you said that, like lay everything at the altar, because you'll get to the devotion stage and you'll know, hey, life can be hard sometimes, but I have full faith and trust that we're going to move through anything that comes our way, because you've done it enough and because you've seen it enough in practice. And it feels like you're able to communicate and move through things with grace and effortlessly. And there's a deep understanding that there's a mutual devotion. And sometimes what happens is people will be trying to kind of subconsciously create a relationship based on things they're seeing outside of them in the devotion stage, where let's say they're in the power struggle stage and one person's dragging their feet on making a commitment, which would generally happen in the rhythm or devotion stages. And they're dragging their feet on making a commitment, and the other person's forcing a commitment, pushing it. as a subconscious strategy or attempt to get to that devotion stage because they're seeing that in other people. But actually, oftentimes one person's dragging their feet because they're not actually feeling devotion. They're not actually feeling rhythm. And so there's
they're not ready. Exactly. We haven't gone through the stages.
Exactly. And so people will take that as, oh, they don't care about me. And you know, you'll usually see people articulate that at that point by saying things like, I love this person. I see this as my forever person, but just I'm not quite ready yet, or something's holding me back and they can't quite put their finger on it. And a lot of times it's actually because they haven't moved into that stage of feeling that devotion, having that rhythm. And so there's a fear. And I think it's actually a righteous fear, in a sense that, well, if we commit from this place to a devoted relationship, what if we're still having these things we haven't worked out yet, and these fights and these arguments? And until we actually see our ability to move through and navigate those things, it makes sense that there's a reservation from one or both people to make a longer term commitment. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really beautiful, because what if, let's say, one person is inviting the devotion, the commitment, you know, I'd like to get married. The other person's anxious, hesitant. In order for devotion to even be available, as you're saying, we must move through the stages before. So, you know, my wife and I, we always talk about how, like, what's coming up for one person is coming up for the other. They just don't know it yet.
Yeah, I love that.
And I find that someone who's more, let's say, anxiously attached, there's a natural tendency, as you were saying, to not vet. And so they're quick to move and try to accelerate the relationship, as you were saying, to try to get to a place. And the other person is anxious or hesitant. Even if that person is afraid of commitment, quote unquote, there is a brilliance even in that hesitation, because they're still not ready for devotion anyways. Even if they're like avoidant, dismissive, all the things, it's like they have to be willing to move through it. And so if they're not willing to move through it, what the fuck are you doing devoting to them? Like, do you know what I'm saying? Yeah, and so that both people have to mature through those rites of passage for devotion to even be possible. Otherwise, it's just fake devotion.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's beautifully said. Exactly. And like you said as well, you know, there's this attempt to create this devotion, or pressure into devotion at times, or push to get to this outcome. But there's the missing of the whole journey, which is that we haven't learned the tools yet, or the
skills. You're not embodying devotion.
Exactly. Yes.
You're like coercing it. You know?
Exactly. And so that's where we have to be able to be like, well, then if we're not at the devotion stage, where are we stuck? Are we not communicating openly in the power struggle? Have we not found the rhythm yet by integrating these things, so that we actually get into the rhythm and the new conditioning of a relationship together that has, you know, trade integration, where we aren't operating these extreme polarities, there's more wholeness, that has the ability to communicate and be vulnerable about our fears and needs, and then actually move through and get to the other side of that, actually hash out the communication and come to resolution. And if we haven't learned to do that significantly and consistently enough, that it now is the ingrained way of operating in the stage, then we're not even in the rhythm. And so once we do it consistently enough, we move through conflict, we do it with ease, we know we can navigate our things together, we know each other more deeply, the mask is off, we're vulnerable openly, and it feels comfortable to be that way. Okay, now we're habituated, now we're in the rhythm. And now devotion is just the natural next rite of passage from that place going forward, because that's, okay, well, we enjoy this relationship now, we're connected over these things, let's do things to habituate, and let's talk about the future. And that's where will feel an actual reciprocity from both parties. And that's where, you know, what's interesting to me is that at that point, if you make it to that stage, you're kind of beyond an attachment diagnosis, right? And obviously you don't get a formal diagnosis for attachment style, but at that point, you're dominantly securely attached anyways, because you've done those things necessary to get to that point, which is communicate openly, know your fears and flaws, know how to navigate them. All these things are rites of passage on the pathway to becoming securely attached as well. And so at that point, it doesn't really matter as much what somebody's attachment style is, because you're naturally going to feel that devotion and you're naturally on that path to secure attachment because of how you're operating and showing up in connection.
That's beautiful. And then if we bring it home, how do we get to what's the rite of passage through to everlasting love?
That is the space that we end up knowing that this is how we're showing up, this is how we're navigating things, and we're actually taking action in our devotions. So it's not a talking about the things we're going to devote to. It's acting them out, playing them out behaviorally in real time. There's a congruence. Exactly. So there's not, oh, we should get married. We should think of having kids. We should move in together. We should start a business together. It's that you are actually in a state where your lives have truly merged in that way. And there's a rootedness and a foundation in there and a fulfillment in there. And, you know, what I really like about the everlasting stage, and this is what you'll hear people report it as, is, you know, this sense of, I'll tell you a story for a second that I think navigates this. I remember my parents went through a hard time, particularly hard time, where there was some infidelity, and I caught it, and I was the one to find out. I was a teenager. Oh, wow. I had a math tutor at the time. And I remember I go to like this after school math tutor in high school. And I remember telling her what happened randomly. I don't know why I would tell the math tutor.
She's like, damn.
And I remember.
Sine, cos, tan. All right.
Yeah. I remember her saying to me, I said to her, and I had a lot of wounds to work through and did a lot of work on this. I remember saying like, oh, somebody's always going to cheat and leave in the relationship. Like, it's always that way. And I remember her saying, I know my husband would never cheat on me. And I know that with certainty. And I remember challenging her as a teenager, this wounded teenager that I was at the time. I said, yeah, but you say that, but how could you ever possibly know that? You can't know that. And I remember saying that to her. And I remember that moment sticking with me so much because she was very like, very this strong, kind of tough lady. I kind of admired her in a sense. And she was very like, had it together and just, you know, in it. And I remember thinking that she was almost the opposite of naive. She was not, a naive would not be a word I would give to her to describe her at all. It would be on the very end of the list. And I remember thinking, well, she's not naive, but how can she know? How could she know that? And I remember grappling, and it really, I thought about that for years after. And it wasn't until I was actually in a relationship like this myself, you know, after doing so much work and healing and with my husband, where there is this deep, true sense of like, nothing's going to come between us. And you just kind of know that. And you know, you trust that you'll navigate and weather storms and you'll move through hard things together. And there's this deep knowing about that. And I think it's because of this deep way that you've learned to operate, where it's like, well, when something hard comes, we know how to address hard things. And so there's just a faith that you'll move through it and a trust in that. And if I had, you know, said that to my 15-year-old self, I would have been like, naive, what a joke, you know?
Totally.
And what I would hear from client after client or people in our programs or all these things when, you know, working with people is that people will report almost that same thing. Oh yeah, I have full faith. Like, I just know we're going to be together for the long run. I just know that. And there's a certainty, and it's not from naivety. It's from a place of like, you know how you're operating and what you're rooted in. And I think that that's actually a reflection, quite honestly, of having done enough work and had enough vulnerability and authenticity and communication, almost like a tree where you get a little sapling in the dating and honeymoon stage and it has these shallow roots, and a storm or a windstorm could come and tear it out of the ground easily. And you nourish it and you water it and there's sunlight, and it happens so many times over and over that the tree gets nourished, that the roots grow so deep that, you know, okay, well, no matter how big the storm is, it's not going to rip the tree out of the ground. And I think that there is a sense of moving truly by the everlasting stage from conditionally based love to much more unconditionally based love, where you know that if something happens or there's a mistake or a concern, you know, we'll figure it out. We'll navigate it. We'll move through it. And there's a sense of that being there. And I think as well for anybody who, you know, was maybe like me when I was younger, who also used to have this really strong thought process of like, yeah, well, you like the person now, but in 10 years you could get bored, or in 10 years they could get bored of you, or you never know. How could you trust the future? And, you know, that was a reflection of where I was at that point in my own life. And now you look at something and you protect it for so long and you invest in it for so long and you nourish it for so long that like, you don't even want like a crack to come, you know, you won't even let something come near that to crack it or to hurt it, because when you invest in something and it's been so great for you and you're so, you develop so much enrichment from it, well, you won't let anything come to hurt it. And so this idea that you'll get bored or change your mind of something you've invested so much in and care so much about is almost this silly, frivolous thought by the time you're at the everlasting stage. Whereas in earlier stages, dating honeymoon, when your whole love relationship is infatuation based, well, somebody else could be infatuated with somebody else. There is a fragility to that, yeah, that goes away over time as you progress through the future stages.
Yeah. And if you move through these, not try to accelerate too fast, but go at the natural pace. You know, I think when we start to actually discover the right pace and the right space for our own individual, because of course that's going to be different when two people's worlds come together. Like, especially for someone who's more avoidant, they'll want to take a little longer. And for someone who's more anxious, they want to speed it up. But it's actually in the mergers and the understanding of those worlds that you find a pace that works together. And it's like, if you can move through these stages and the rites of passage, then I love what you're saying, because we get to this place where it's like, well, if my wife and I, we had a kid. So of course, in that process, it's more stressful. Life's more stressful. Sure. Everything's different. You go from being a couple to being a family. Your old world where you could just watch TV together, is that's dead. So but there's just like a knowing that this is a season. And because we are devoted and in that place of like, I think you probably naturally in the everlasting, then when you do meet a new power struggle that will come from the revelation of more stuff, that you just naturally move through all those processes. Because as you were saying, you have these ingrained skills that are like, oh, I'm really frustrated. And this is really da 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 da, because you've learned how to advocate for yourself or how to be more flexible. My wife and I have very similar patterns that you're talking about, except I'm you and she's your husband, in terms of flexibility. Which is very normal. I'm more. Yeah,
there's like usually one that leans one direction.
Yeah, and I'm like, it's generally women who are one way versus, although there's a lot of interesting stuff on women becoming much more avoidant now, which is, that's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, to your point, what happens a lot is you can have these temporary regressions back into the power struggle stage. But for the most part, that's so much more rare because you have the foundational skills to navigate your way through them. It's almost like, if you deal with something so proactively, it just doesn't have the same capacity to fester.
Yeah, they're not power struggles. They're just regular relational.
Exactly. Yeah, now, there will be extreme exceptions. So you may see that somebody goes through a really traumatic event in their family. They go through a lot of loss and grief, and then they sort of unravel. And of course, our personal patterns will play into relational patterns, personal trauma or grief or things like that.
Right.
And then obviously, it'll change the relationship. So in extreme cases, you know, I can think of one couple that I was with, for example, and they saw me, they were stuck in the power struggle. They then came through that, moved into the everlasting stage, and then revisited with me. Yeah, this is kind of a tragic story, but revisited with me 3 years later because they had lost one of their kids and one of their kids had passed away. And so, you know, huge tragedy. And then they were in a power struggle because the inordinate amount of grief and stress and just kind of broke them both. And now there's a rebuilding in really extremes. And that's a really extreme case, but in hard, hard situations, yes, you can regress.
That breaks people up a lot.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That loss, especially like how we hold grief, you know, if one person's more of a provider, there's not a lot of option to go deep into the, I mean, there's so much to that, but I really agree. It's like the traumas or the losses or whatever it is will bring forward a reinvention of self.
Yeah, exactly. The things that will tear us to pieces a little bit, right? Break us, then we have to restart from somewhere. It's almost like we're rebuilding ourselves and thus the relationship will be rebuilt. So in that case, I will say in their case, they actually were able to really reconnect and heal and grow. And so it's a nice outcome, despite how tragic it is. But you know, so extreme cases, that's a really extreme case, but can that sort of shatter people a little bit for a period of time, can regress completely back into the power struggle, but then you'll still know the skills and tools needed to then rebuild again. And if both
that's
people
super
are willing.
Interesting. That made me think about how like the collective trauma of COVID actually really thrust so many people back into power struggles. Because now it's like, well, what do I believe in? Who am I? What do you believe in? Who are you? Which I think it was weaponized in a lot of ways, but it like almost like artificially thrust people back into power struggles where there was synergy and now they created things that created opposition. Interesting. I was just thinking about that.
Well, I think that it's so funny. Now that you said that, I actually think that the root, I never thought of this until this moment, of is like, so why? What is the actual root? And I had sort of always put it in my mind as like, oh, extremely traumatic events. But I actually think it to better summarize it, it would be events that create an identity crisis. Because then if your individual sense of self has been completely disrupted or fragmented because of a specific event and everything you believed has changed, well, your conditioned relationship and the fabric it's built upon has to do with two whole senses of self.
So,
and so if one shatters or breaks, then that makes sense. And so a lot of people, I think during COVID, were left feeling like, what the heck? You know, a lot of people were like, well, everything I believed has maybe been challenged or questioned or changed in a lot of cases. Maybe some people clung on more strongly to their opinions. And as
right.
soon as one person has an identity breakdown, it will break down the dynamic of the entire relationship.
And well, family systems, cultural systems. It's interesting. I'm not saying if I was into social engineering, I'm not saying it would be great social engineering, but if you were into social engineering, it would be brilliant to bring forward something that is moralized and triggers values, because that would cause a rupture and a power struggle in almost all couples.
100%. And I think,
and families.
Yeah. Families, societies, you know, yeah. group dynamics, communities. I also think that what's interesting is I read this book at one point that was recommended to me when I was investigating some of these sort of like social cultural phenomenons around disastrous events and how people respond to them. And I believe, if I'm not forgetting the title, it was a few years ago now, it was called Disaster Something. And I'll have to look it up. But the whole concept was about the way that people choose to give up their rights and freedoms is only when something is disastrous enough that they're afraid enough that they'll be willing to do so. And to your point of the social engineering piece, it's almost like at a macro scale, if there's, you know, the personal identity crises that happen because everything we've been challenged has been, you know, now has to be questioned, or everything we've been believed is being questioned and challenged. And then on top of that, there's a disaster where we're confused and we're afraid. Well, okay, now we sort of end up. And you see this on a micro level when people have a weak sense of self. Like you think of people who have borderline personality disorder. And one of the most common features of somebody with BPD that's important to recognize is they have an unstable sense of self, is what it says in the DSM. And it's because they don't have a sense of personal boundaries or parameters, or they've had to people please and give themselves up so much to survive their childhood that they don't have a sense of self. And and people with an unstable sense of self are more often going to be controlled for periods of time, or end up in controlling and abusive relationships. And so it's interesting because on a macro scale, if you play that out, well, if you create a collective identity crisis and then there's the opportunity to feel very afraid, well, now we're going to be much more apt to go with the flow of what's being told to us because we don't have a leg to stand on. We don't have a sense of self to really guide it and help us navigate those challenges.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you frame it like that first part, the honeymoon phase and then the power struggle, you end up with a similar thing culturally again, because now we're in our wounds, we're separated. We have to find a way out. We have to find a way through operating from like giving up our sovereignty, our choice. It makes us much, yeah, as you're saying, like if we're predisposed to people pleasing, we will more likely be manipulated by that.
100%. And you know, what's so interesting is like on the, you know, I when I would work with a lot of people who came out of abusive relationships, one of the big themes I would always see is that they, if you sort of look back on like their themes and patterns, you would see they tended to first be quite critical of themselves. They would manipulate themselves to please others. They would empathize with other people so much, but kind of at the expense of themselves. And they would struggle to set boundaries. And so they were a subconscious match, right? Because we one of the big features driving attraction is we're attracted to people who treat us the way we treat ourselves, because we see it as familiar and thus safe. So what you see is people would get into relationships with abusive people. Their conscious mind would quote unquote know better. Oh, I saw the red flags. I don't know why I ignored them. I knew it wasn't right that they talked to me that way, but I loved them, you know, and it's no fault of their own, right? The person is victimized by being in an abusive relationship, but a lot of times they first treated themselves in an abusive way. And so the alarm bells didn't go off. So conscious mind says, oh yeah, you know, this isn't healthy, but they are also critical. criticizing themselves. They're also, people pleasing. So they're giving up themselves to please others. And there's always this sort of set of subconscious patterns and themes where people have roots in their willingness to do that, that then make them more likely to be subject to those types of painful events and relationships. And so, we tend to go back to what we know and how we learn to survive things when we're having an identity crisis. And so when everything's being questioned and challenged, then we go back into our old coping skills and mechanisms, unless we've really done a lot of work on those subconscious themes.
Well, it shows you that if you were to move through all these stages of relationship with someone else, if you do encounter something socially engineered or a traumatic collective experience too, of course that can happen, you are less likely to go back to being enslaved by your wounds because you have already moved through them relationally. So your nervous system would even know a different way. Although it would be our natural default to, like, in high stress to, like, want to go back to it just through automation. There's actually a learned interrupt. It's like, wait, no. I see what I'm doing here. I navigated that a lot of recognizing that my people pleasing interpersonally, as it got resolved, then I noticed where it was showing up more collectively, like in my self-expression on social media. And so I was just like expanding my healing in a lot of ways. So I thought it was resolved romantically, but because I'd done the groundwork romantically, it needed to be resolved collectively too.
Yes. And still that makes a lot of sense. I love that though, because to your point, I think it's a pattern interrupt, but I also think it's a reconditioning that happens. I really do think that. I think that there's a lot of deep changes for sure. Interesting.
It's so powerful. Yeah. It seems like the healing of the collective would be through this work.
I 100% agree that, like, relationally, and I know we were talking about this earlier, is like almost that quote, right? Like, everything shows you to yourself. If I'm irritated by every rub, how will I ever be polished? Well, if you do the work in relationships first, there's enough reconditioning that happens within you as a person that then you're primed to step out of your patterns if things happen in a different form in the collective.
Yeah.
And so it brings this really interesting discussion point that's like, well, look at the collective now. Like, there's all this divisiveness. Everybody thinks they're on these, like, polarities. There's so much division in our world, which actually is a lot less than people think. You know, there's this idea of the silent, exhausted majority, who are like almost 70% of people are somewhere just in the middle that would agree on way more things. But if you haven't learned to navigate conflict and communication and vulnerability in your interpersonal closest relationships, like in your marriage or romantic relationship or home, well, then you're not actually equipped to go and navigate those challenges properly in the collective.
Fascinating.
And yeah.
Yeah. Which you wouldn't even know that nuance exists because you've never experienced it.
Yes, exactly. It would be like an unknown unknown.
God damn, that's good. Okay. Everybody, go learn more about the six stages of relationship. We need to do it for humanity. Guys, I love our conversations. Thanks so much for sharing all these incredible insights. And you just have, again, as I said at the beginning, a way of walking people through something that they're experiencing and labeling it and being able to humanize it and then also practically move through it. So where can people find out more about you, your work, and the six stages?
Yeah, so people can find out more about me at thepersonaldevelopmentschool.com. So it's personaldevelopmentschool.com. And we have a six stages relationship quiz that'll be on there and a whole in-depth course about it and the rites of passage. And I'm also on YouTube at Thais Gibson-thepersonaldevelopmentschool.
She puts out a new video every day. It's incredible. So everybody go check those links out. Thais, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I love our conversations too and always appreciate it.